Genie. He walked to prove he was a hero and get his children back.
I suppose in the end his was a journey of a kind, said Rex. Just a different one.
He replaced his cup carefully on a coaster, so as not to mark the table. The reporter made a brief reference to Harold Fry, and an image flashed up in which he was shrinking from the camera. He looked like a shadow, dirty, haggard, afraid. In an exclusive interview, Rich Lyon explained from the quayside that the elderly Devon Pilgrim was suffering from fatigue and complicated emotional issues. He had been forced to retire from the walk south of Newcastle.
But Queenie is alive. That's the main thing. It was lucky me and the guys were there to step in.
Maureen scoffed. For heaven's sake, he can't even speak proper English. Rich clasped his hands together above his head in a gesture of victory.
I know Harold would be moved by your support.
The jostling crowd of well-wishers cheered. The report ended with a shot of the pinkish stones of the quay wall, where several council workers were removing placards that spelt out a slogan. One man worked from the beginning, the other man from the end, picking each letter up and sliding it into their van, so that all that was left was the message, Weed welcomes Ha. Maureen snapped off the television and paced the room. They're sweeping him under the carpet, she said. They're ashamed of putting their trust in him, so now they have to make him out to be a fool. It's shocking. He didn't even ask for their attention in the first place. Rex pursed his mouth in thought.
At least people will leave him alone now. At least it's just the walk and Harold.
Maureen stared out at the sky. She could not speak. Chapter 25 Harold and the Dog. It had come as a relief to Harold to walk alone again. He and Dog took up their own rhythm, and there was no debating, no arguing. From Newcastle to Hexham, they had stopped when they were tired and taken up when they were refreshed. They began to walk the dawns again, and sometimes the nights, and he was filled with renewed hope. He was happiest like this, watching the lights come on at the windows and people going about their lives, unobserved and yet tender for the strangeness of others. He was open once more to the thoughts and memories that played through his head. Maureen, Queenie, and David were his companions. He felt whole again. He thought of Maureen's body against his in the early years of their marriage, and the beautiful darkness between her legs. He pictured David staring out of his bedroom window so intently, it was as if the outside world had robbed him of something. He remembered driving beside Queenie while she sucked on mints and sang another song backwards. Harold and Dog were so close to Berwick, they must do nothing but walk. After his experience with the Pilgrims, he was anxious to avoid public attention. In talking to strangers and listening, he feared he had created a need in them to be carried, and he hadn't the strength for that anymore. If he and Dog came to a built-up area and could not bypass it, they slept in fields on its fringes until dark, and then crossed in the early hours of the morning. They ate what they found in hedgerows and bins. They picked only from the allotments or trees that looked uncared for. They still stopped to taste spring water wherever it bubbled up, but they troubled no one. Once or twice someone asked for his photograph, and he obliged, though he found it hard to look into the camera. Occasionally a passerby recognized him and offered food. A man who was possibly a journalist asked if he was Harold Fry, but since he was careful to keep his head low, and since he stuck to the shadows and the wider spaces, people mostly left him alone. He even avoided his reflection.
"I hope you feel better," said a graceful woman with a greyhound. "It was such a shame to lose you. My husband and I wept."
Not understanding, Harold thanked her and moved on. The land heaved ahead and formed dark peaks.
Strong winds came from west to north, bringing rain. It was too cold to sleep. He lay rigid within his sleeping bag, watching patches of cloud as they scattered across the moon, and trying to keep warm. The dog lay against him in the sleeping bag. Its ribs were cavernous. He thought of the day David swam out at Bantham, and the fragility of his son against the Coast Guard's tanned arms. He remembered the nicks in David's skull, where he had dug the razor, and how he used to haul David upstairs before he was sick again. All those times David had put his body at risk, as if in defiance of the ordinariness that was his father. Harold began to shiver. It started as a tremble that caused his teeth to rattle, but seemed to gain momentum. His fingers, toes, arms and legs were shaking so hard they hurt. He looked out, hoping for comfort or distraction, but found no fellowship in the land as he had before. The moon shone, the wind blew. His need for warmth made no impression. The place was not cruel. It was worse. It didn't notice. Harold was alone, without Maureen or Queenie or David, in a place that did not see, shaking and shaking in a sleeping bag. He tried gritting his teeth and clenching his fists, but that made it worse. Far away, foxes were cornering an animal, their anarchic cries cutting through the night air. His wet clothes stung against his skin and stole the warmth from him. He was cold to the core. The only thing that would stop him shaking would be when his inner organs froze over. He no longer had the wherewithal to resist even the cold. Harold was sure he would be better once he was back on his feet, but he wasn't. There was no escaping what he had realized as he fought for warmth in the night. With or without him, the moon and the wind would go on, rising and falling. The land would keep stretching ahead until it hit the sea. People would keep dying. It made no difference whether Harold walked or trembled or stayed at home. What began as a flat, subdued feeling grew over the hours into something more violently accusing. The more he dwelt on how little he mattered, the more he believed it. Who was he to go to Queenie? What did it matter if Rich Lyon took his place? Every time he paused for breath, or rubbed at his legs to get the blood moving, the dog sat at his feet, watching with concern. It stopped straying from Harold's path. It stopped bringing stones. Harold thought of his journey so far, the people he had met, the places he had seen, the skies beneath which he had slept. Until now, he had held them in his mind like a collection of souvenirs. They had kept him going when the walking was so arduous he had wanted to give up. But now he thought of those people, places and skies, and he could no longer see himself among them. The roads he had walked were full of different cars. The people he had passed were passing other people. His footprints, however firm, would be washed away by rain. It was as if he had never been in any of the places he had been, or met the strangers he had met. He looked behind, and already there was no trace, no sign of him anywhere. The trees gave up their branches to the wind as fluidly as tentacles in water. He had made a mess of being a husband, father, and friend. He'd even made a mess of being a son. It wasn't simply that he had betrayed Queenie, and that his parents did not want him. It wasn't simply that he had made a mess of everything with his wife and son. It was rather that he passed through life and left no impression. He meant nothing. Harold went across the A696 in the direction of Cambo, and realized the dog was missing. He felt a shower of panic. He wondered if the dog had been hurt, and he hadn't noticed. He retraced his steps, scouring the road and the gutters, but there was no sign of the animal. He tried to remember when he had last registered its presence. It must be hours since they had shared a sandwich on a bench. Or was that the day before? He couldn't believe he had failed even in this simple task. He was waving down cars, asking drivers if they had seen a dog, a little tufty thing about so high, but they sped away, as if he were dangerous. Catching sight of him, a small child clung to her car seat and sobbed. There was nothing for it but to retrace his steps towards Hexham. He found Dog sitting in a bus shelter at the feet of a young girl. She was wearing a school uniform and had long dark hair that was almost the autumn colour of its fur and a kind look about her. Stooping to pat its head, she picked up something by her shoe and stowed it in her pocket. "Don't throw the stone," Harold was about to call, but he didn't. The girl's bus drew up beside her and she got on it, followed by the dog. It looked as if it knew where it was heading. He watched the bus drive away, with the girl and the dog on it. They didn't look back or wave. He reasoned the animal had made its own decision. It had chosen to walk with Harold for a while, and then it had chosen to stop, and walk instead with the young girl. Life was like that. But in losing his last companion, Harold felt a further layer of skin had been ripped from him. He was afraid of what would come next. He knew he hadn't got it in him to take much more. The hours turned into days, and he couldn't remember how one was different from another. He began to make mistakes. He would set off with the first cracks of dawn, compelled to go towards the emerging light, regardless of whether or not it lay in the direction of Berwick. He argued with his compass when it pointed south, convinced it was broken, or worse, that it was deliberately lying. Sometimes he walked 10 miles, only to discover he had travelled a large, looping circle, and was back almost where he had started. He took diversions to follow a shout or a figure, but they led to nothing. Near the crest of a hill, he saw a woman calling for help, but after an hour of climbing, he found she was a dead tree trunk. He frequently lost his footing and stumbled. When his glasses snapped a second time, he left them behind. Deprived of rest and hope, other things began to slip from him. He found he couldn't remember David's face. He could picture his dark eyes and the way they stared. But when he tried to conjure up the fringe that flopped over them, he could see only Queenie's tight curls. It was like fixing a jigsaw together in his mind, but without all the pieces. How could his head be so cruel? Harold lost all sense of time, and whether or not he had eaten. It wasn't that he had forgotten. He no longer cared. He no longer took any interest in what he saw, or the difference between things or their names. A tree was no more than another of the things he passed, and sometimes the only words in his head were the ones that asked why he was still walking when it would make no difference. A lone crow passed overhead, its black wings beating the air like a whip, and filled him with such inhuman fear, he went scampering for shelter. So expansive was the land, and so small was he, that when he glanced back, trying to gauge the distance he had travelled, it seemed as if he had not advanced at all. His feet fell on exactly the same place where he had lifted them. He looked at the peaks on the horizon, the waves of turf, the boulders of rock. The grey houses tucked among them were so small, so temporary, it was a wonder they stayed up. "We hang on by so little," he thought, and felt the full despair of knowing that. Harold walked under the heat of the sun, the pelting of the rain, and the blue cold of the moon. But he no longer knew how far he had come. He sat beneath a hard night sky, alive with stars, and watched as his hands turned purple. He knew he should lift his hands, guide them to his mouth and blow on the knuckles, but the idea of flexing one set of muscles and then another was too much. He couldn't remember which muscles served which limbs. He couldn't remember how it would help. It was easier simply to sit, absorbed in the night and the nothing that was all around him. It was easier to give up than keep moving. Late one night, Harold rang Maureen from a phone box. He reversed the charges as normal, and when he heard her voice, he said,
"I can't do it. I can't finish."
She said nothing. He wondered if she had thought better of missing him, or maybe she had been asleep.
"I can't do it, Maureen," he repeated.
She gave a gulp down the telephone. "Harold, where are you?" He looked at the outside world. Traffic shot past. There were lights and people hurrying home. A billboard advertised a television program coming this autumn, and showed a giant-sized policewoman smiling. Beyond stood all the darkness that lay between himself and wherever he was going.
"I don't know where I am."
"Do you know where you've come from?"
"No."
"The name of a village?"
"I don't know. I think I stopped seeing things quite a while ago."
"I see," she said, in a way that sounded as if she saw other things too. He swallowed hard.
"Wherever I am now might be the gateway to the Cheviot Hills. Something like that. I maybe noticed a sign. But maybe that was a few days ago. There have been hills. And gorse, too. A lot of bracken."
He heard a sharp intake of breath and then another. He could picture her face, the way her mouth worked open and shut when she was thinking. He said again,
"I want to come home, Maureen. You were right, I can't do it. I don't want to."
At last her voice came. It sounded slow and careful, as if she were reining in words. "Harold, I'm going to try and work out where you are and what to do. I want you to give me half an hour. Can you do that?" He pressed his forehead on the glass, savouring the sound of her. "Can you phone me back?" He nodded. He forgot she couldn't see. "Harold?" She called as if he needed reminding who he was. "Harold, are you there?"
"I'm listening."
"Give me half an hour, that's all." He tried to walk the streets of the town, so that time would pass more quickly. There were people queuing outside a fish and chip shop, and a man being sick in the gutter. The further he strayed from the phone box, the more afraid he became, as if the safe part of himself still remained there, waiting for Maureen. The hills were terrible, deep giants impinging on the night sky. A gang of young men were striding into the road, shouting at cars and throwing beer cans. Harold cowered in the shadows, afraid of being seen. He was going home, and he didn't know how he would tell people that he didn't make it, but it didn't matter. It was an insane idea, and he needed to stop. If he wrote another letter, Queenie would understand. He phoned Maureen and reversed the charges.
"It's me again."
She didn't reply. She gave a gulping noise.
He had to say, "It's Harold."
"Yes," she gulped again.
"Shall I phone later?"
"No." She paused and then she said slowly, "Rex is here. We've looked at the map. We made a few calls. He has been on his computer. We even got out your motorist's guide to Great Britain." She still sounded not right. Her words came light against his ear, as if she had run a long way and was struggling to settle her breath. Harold had to press the phone against his ear to hear her properly.
"Will you say hello to Rex?"
At this she gave a laugh, a short, fluttery one. "He says hello, too." There followed more strange swallowing noises, like hiccups, but smaller. Then, "Rex thinks you must be in Woola."
"Woola.
Does that sound right?"
"I don't know. It's all beginning to sound the same."
"We think you must have taken a wrong turn."
He was about to say he had taken many, but it was too much effort.
"There's a hotel called the Black Swan. I think it sounds nice, and so does Rex. I have booked you a room, Harold. They know to expect you."
"But you're forgetting I have no money, and I must look terrible."
"I paid over the phone by card, and it doesn't matter how you look."
"When will you be here? Will Rex come too?"
He paused at the end of both questions, but Maureen's voice gave nothing. He even wondered if she had put the phone down.
"You are coming,"
he said, his blood warming with panic. She hadn't gone. He heard her sucking in a long breath, as if she had burnt her hand. Suddenly her voice shot out so loud and fast it hurt his ear. He had to hold the handset slightly away. "Queenie is still alive, Harold. You asked for her to wait, and you see she is waiting. Rex and I checked the weather forecast, and they have slapped happy sunshapes all over the United Kingdom. You'll feel better in the morning."
"Maureen?" She was his last chance. "I can't do it. I was wrong."
She didn't hear. Or if she heard, she wouldn't allow the gravity of what he was saying. Her voice kept coming at him, rising in pitch. "Keep walking. It's only 16 more miles to Berwick. You can do it, Harold. Remember to stay on the B6525. He didn't know how to say what he was feeling after that. So he hung up. As Maureen had told him to, Harold checked into the hotel. He couldn't look at the receptionist or the young porter who insisted on leading him to his room and opening the door on his behalf. The chap drew the curtains over the windows and showed him how to change the air conditioning, and where he would find the ensuite bathroom, as well as the minibar and Corby trouser press. Harold nodded, but he didn't see. The air felt chilled and hard.
"Can I fetch you a drink, sir?"
asked the porter. Harold could not explain about himself and alcohol. He merely turned away. With the porter gone, he lay fully clothed on the bed, and all he could think was that he did not want to keep going. He slept briefly, and woke with a start. Martina's partner's compass. He groped his hand in his trouser pocket, and pulled it out, and tried the other. The compass wasn't there. It wasn't in the bed or on the floor. It wasn't even in the lift. He must have left it in the phone box. The porter unbolted the main doors and promised to wait. Harold ran so hard that his breath cut into the cavities of his chest like blows. He swung open the door of the kiosk, but the compass had gone. Maybe it was the shock of being once more inside a room, and lying on a bed with clean sheets and soft pillows. But that night, Harold started to cry. He couldn't believe he had been so foolish as to lose Martina's compass. He tried to tell himself it was only a thing, she would understand. But all he could feel was the loss of its weight from his pocket. So vast its absence amounted to a presence. He feared that in mislaying the compass, he had also lost an essential, steadying part of himself. Even when he briefly slipped into something that was like unconsciousness, his head swarmed with images. He saw the man from Bath in the dress with his punched eye. He saw the oncologist staring at Queenie's letter, and the woman who loved Jane Austen talking into mid-air. There was the cycling mother with her scarred arms. He asked himself again, why a person would do that. He curled into the pillow and dreamed of the silver-haired gentleman who travelled by train to see the boy with trainers. He saw Martina waiting for the man who was never going to return. And what about the waitress who would never leave South Brent? And Wilf, and Kate, too, all those people searching for happiness. He woke crying, and continued to cry all day as he walked. Maureen received a postcard with a picture of the Cheviots, bearing no stamp. The message read, "Weather good, H. X." There was another postcard the following day, showing Hadrian's Wall, but this had no message. The cards came every day. Sometimes there were several. He wrote the briefest messages. "Rain, not good. Walking. I miss you." Once he drew a hill shape, another time a squiggly W that was possibly a bird. Often the cards were blank. She asked the postman to look out for them at the sorting office. She would pay the extra charges. The messages were more precious than love letters, she said. Harold did not ring again. She waited in every night, but to no avail. It tortured her that she had let him go, when he needed her help. She had booked the hotel and spoken to Harold through tears, but she and Rex had talked it over and over. If he gave up when he was so close to arriving, he would regret it for the rest of his life. Early July had brought winds and heavy rain. Her bamboo stakes tilted at a drunken angle towards the ground, and the tips of her bean plants groped their blind passage into air. Harold's postcards continued to arrive, but they no longer mapped a steady northward path. There was one from Kelso, but by her reckoning that was 23 miles west of where he should be. Another came from Eccles, and also from Coldstream, again too far west of Berwick. Almost every hour she resolved to ring the police, only to realize as she lifted the phone that it was not her place to stop Harold, when he must surely arrive any day. She rarely slept a full night. She feared that by giving in to unconsciousness, she surrendered her one contact with her husband, and might lose him altogether. She sat outside on a patio chair beneath the stars, keeping vigil for the man who somewhere very far away was sheltering under that same sky. Now and again, Rex brought her tea in the early morning, and a travel blanket from his car. They watched the night lose its darkness, and the pearl light of dawn, without speaking or moving. More than anything, Maureen wanted Harold home. Chapter 26. Harold and the Cafe. The last stretch was the worst. All Harold could see was road. He had no thoughts. The earlier damage to his right leg had flared up again and caused him to limp. There was no pleasure to be had. He was in a place where it did not exist. Flies swarmed in a cloud around his head. Sometimes there were bites, maybe stings. The fields were immense and empty, and the cars were drawn along the roads like toys. Another peak, another sky, another mile. It was all the same. It both bored and overwhelmed him to the point of surrender. He often forgot where he was heading. Without love, nothing had... What? What was the word for it? He couldn't remember. He thought it began with a V, and he wanted to say vulva, but that surely wasn't right. Nothing could be made to matter very much. The blackness crept from the sky. The rain slashed his skin. The winds blew so hard he struggled to keep his balance. He fell asleep wet and woke wet. He would never know again what it was to be warm. The nightmare pictures Harold thought he had left behind were back, and there was no escaping them. Awake or asleep, he relived the past, and felt the fresh horror of it. he saw himself flailing with an axe at the wooden planks of his garden shed, his hands ripped and full of splinters, his head swinging with whiskey. He saw his fists sprouting blood over thousands of coloured glass pins. He heard himself praying, eyes screwed up, hands clenched, and the words meaning nothing. Other times he saw Maureen turn her back on him and disappear into a dazzling ball of light. The 20 years that had passed were shorn away. There was no hiding behind the ordinary or even the cliché. Like the detail in the land, these things no longer existed. No one could imagine such loneliness. He shouted once, but no sound came back. He felt the cold deep inside him, as if even his bones were freezing over. He closed his eyes to sleep, convinced he would not survive, and having no will to fight that. When he woke and felt the stiffness of his clothes cutting his skin and his face burnt with the sun, or maybe the cold, he got up and plodded on. A bulging in his shoes made a rip at the seam, and the soles were thin as fabric. His toes would be through the leather at any moment. He bound them with the roll of blue duct tape, round and round and round, crossing underneath the foot and up over towards the ankle, so that the shoe was a part of himself. Or was it the other way round? He was beginning to believe they had a will of their own. On, on, on. These were the only words. He didn't know whether they were ones he cried out, or words in his mind, or whether someone else was calling them. He thought he might be the only person left in the world. There was no more than the road. He was no more than a body that housed a walk. He was blue duct tape feet and Berwick upon Tweed. At 3:30 on a Tuesday afternoon, Harold smelt salt in the wind. An hour later, he reached the brow of a hill and saw a town lying before him, fringed by the endless gap that was the sea. He approached the pinkish-grey town walls, but no one stopped, or looked twice, or offered him food. 87 days after setting out to post a letter, Harold Fry arrived at the gates of St. Bernardine's Hospice. Including mistakes and diversions, his journey had amounted to 627 miles. The building before him was modern and unassuming, flanked by trembling trees. There was an old-fashioned street lamp close to the main entrance, and a sign pointing to a car park. Several bodies sat in deck chairs on the lawn, like clothes set out to dry. A seagull wheeled and barked overhead. Harold walked the soft curve of the tarmac drive and lifted his finger to the buzzer. He wished the moment would hold itself. Like an image cut out of time, his dark finger against the white button, the sun on his shoulders, the seagull laughing. His journey was over. Harold's mind fled back over the miles that had brought him to this place. He saw roads, hills, houses, fences, shopping centres, street lights and post boxes. And there was nothing extraordinary about any of them. They were simply things he had passed, that anyone might have passed. The thought filled him with sudden anguish, and he was afraid at the point where he had least expected to feel anything other than triumph. How did he ever believe that those very commonplace things would add up to something more? His finger remained, suspended over the buzzer, but not pressing it. What had it all been about? He thought of the people who had helped him. He thought of the unwanted, the unloved. He numbered himself among them. And then he considered what must follow from here. He would give his presents to Queenie and thank her. But then what? he would return to the old life he had almost forgotten, where people staked trinkets between themselves and the outside world, where he lay in one bedroom, not sleeping, and Maureen lay in another. Harold replaced his rucksack on his shoulder and turned from the hospice. As he left the gates, the figures lying in deck chairs did not look up. No one was expecting him, and so no one appeared to notice his arrival or his departure. The most extraordinary moment of Harold's life had come and gone without trace. In a small cafe, Harold asked a waitress for a glass of water and use of the bathroom. He apologized that he had no money. He waited patiently as the waitress's eye took in his tangled hair, his ripped jacket and tie, and travelled down the length of his mud-soaked trousers to land on his feet that were more blue duct tape than yachting shoe. Her mouth frowned, and she glanced over her shoulder towards an older woman in a grey jacket who was talking to customers. This second woman was clearly the more senior. The waitress said, "You'd better be quick, then." She ushered him towards a door, without touching any part of him. In the mirror, Harold met a face he only dimly knew. The skin hung in dark folds, as if there was too much of it for the bone behind. He appeared to have several cuts to the forehead and cheekbone. His hair and beard were wilder than he expected, and from his eyebrows and nostrils shot stray long hairs like wires. He was a joke old man, a misfit. He looked nothing like the man who had set off with a letter. He looked nothing like the man who had posed for photographs and worn a pilgrim T-shirt. The waitress provided water in a disposable cup, but did not invite him to sit. He asked if anyone might lend him a razor or a comb, but the manageress in the grey jacket came swiftly over and pointed to the sign at the window. "No begging." She asked him to leave, or she would have to call the police. No one looked up as he moved to the door. He wondered if he smelt bad. He had been outside so long, he had forgotten which smells were good and which were not. He knew people were embarrassed on his behalf, and wished to spare them that. At a table beside the window, a young man and his wife crooned over their baby. There rose such pain inside Harold, he didn't know how he would keep upright. He turned to the manageress and the tea-shop people, and he met them face on. He said, "I want my son." Speaking the words sent his body shaking, not with a gentle shiver, but a spasmic shudder that came from deep inside. His face twisted as grief tore through his chest muscles and swelled its passage up his throat. "Where is he?" said the manageress. Harold squeezed his hands to keep himself from falling. The manageress said, "Do you see your son here? Is he in Berwick?" A customer put his hand on Harold's arm. He said more gently, "Excuse me, sir. Are you the man who was walking?" Harold gasped. It was the kindness of the man that unpicked him. "My wife and I read about what you did. We had a friend we had lost touch with. Last weekend we went to visit. We spoke of you." Harold let the man talk and hold his arm, but he couldn't reply or move his face. "Who is your son? What is his name?" said the man. "Maybe I could help." "His name is..." Suddenly Harold's heart plummeted, as if he had stepped over a wall and was tumbling through emptiness. "He's my son. His name is..." The manageress looked coolly back at him, waiting, waiting, with the customers behind her and the kind man with his hand on Harold's sleeve. They had no idea. No idea of the horror, the confusion, the remorse raging inside him. He couldn't remember his son's name. Out on the street, a young woman tried to give him a piece of paper.
It's salsa dancing classes for the over-60s, she said. You should come, it's never too late.
But it was. It was far too late. Harold shook his head wildly and took a few more staggering steps. His legs felt boned.
Please take the leaflet, said the girl. Take the lot, you can throw them in a bin if you like. I just want to go home.
Harold stumbled the streets of Berwick with the wadge of leaflets, not knowing where he was going. People swerved to avoid him, but he didn't stop. He could forgive his parents for not wanting him, for not showing him how to love, or even giving him the vocabulary. He could forgive their parents and their parents before that. All Harold wanted was his child. Chapter 27 Harold and Another Letter. Dear girl in the garage, I owe you the full story. 20 years ago, I buried my son. It is not something a father should have to do. I wanted to know the man he would become. I still do. To this day, I don't understand why he did it. He was depressed and addicted to mixing alcohol with pills. He couldn't get a job. But I wish with all my heart he had spoken to me. He hanged himself in my garden shed. He did it with some rope, tied to one of the hooks I used for garden tools. He was so full of the alcohol and pills, the coroner said it must have taken a long time to tie the noose. The verdict was suicide. It was me who discovered him. I can barely write this. At the time, I prayed. Although, as I told you at the garage, I am not a religious man. I said, Dear God, please let him be okay. I will do anything. I lifted him down, but there was no life. I was too late. I wish they hadn't told me about him taking all that time to tie the noose. My wife took it terribly. She wouldn't leave the house. She put up net curtains because she didn't want the neighbours prying. Gradually those people moved away, and no one knew about us or what had happened. But every time Maureen looked at me, I knew she saw David dead. She began talking to him. He was with her, she said. She was always waiting for him. Maureen keeps his room exactly as it was the day he died. And sometimes it makes me sad all over again. But it is what my wife wants. She can't let him be dead, and I understand that. It is too much for a mother to bear. Queenie knew all about David, but she didn't say anything. She looked out for me. She fetched tea with sugar and talked about the weather. Only once she said, Maybe you've had enough now, Mr. Fry, because that was the other thing. I was drinking. It started off as just one to keep me steady before the coroner's report. But I was keeping the bottles in paper bags under my desk. God knows how I drove home at night. I just wanted to stop feeling. When I was really out of it one night, I dismantled the garden shed. But even that wasn't enough. So I broke into the brewery, and I did something terrible. Queenie knew it had to be me, and she took the blame. She was fired on the spot, and then she disappeared. I heard she had been warned to get out of the southwest if she knew what was good for her. I also overheard a secretary who was friendly with Queenie's landlady saying that she had not left a forwarding address. I let her go. I let her take the blame. But I gave up drinking. Maureen and I fought for a long time. And then gradually we stopped talking. She moved out of our bedroom. She stopped loving me. There were many times I thought she would leave, but she didn't. I slept badly every night. People think I am walking because there was a romance between myself and Queenie all those years ago. But it isn't true. I walked because she saved me, and I never said thank you. And this is why I am writing to you. I want you to know how much you helped me all those weeks ago, when you told me about your faith and your aunt, although I fear my courage has never matched yours. With best wishes and my humble thanks, Harold, (Fry). P.S. I apologize for not knowing your name. Chapter 28. Maureen and the Visitor. For days, Maureen had been preparing the house for Harold's return. She had taken the two photographs he kept in his bedside drawer and measured them up for frames. She had repainted the best room a soft shade of yellow, and hung a pair of pale blue velvet curtains at the window, which she had picked up at the charity shop, good as new, and shortened. She baked cakes to store in the freezer, as well as a selection of pies, moussaka, lasagna, and boeuf bourguignon, all those dishes she had cooked in the days when David was alive. There were jars of her runner bean chutney in the cupboard, along with pickled onions and beetroot. She kept lists in the kitchen and bedroom. There was so much to do. And yet sometimes, when she looked out of the window, or lay awake listening to the gulls crying like children, she felt that despite her activity, there was something about it that was inactive, as if she were missing the point. Supposing Harold returned home and told her he needed to walk again? Supposing he had outgrown her, after all? A ring at the doorbell in the early morning brought her downstairs. She found a sallow-faced young girl waiting on the threshold, with lank hair, and wearing a black duffel coat, although it was already warm.
"Please could I come in, Mrs. Fry?"
Over tea and several apricot flapjacks, the girl told her she was the one who had given Harold the burger all those weeks ago. He had sent her many lovely postcards. Although due to his sudden rise to fame, there had been an inconvenient number of fans and journalists hanging about the garage. In the end, her boss had been obliged to ask her to leave for health and safety reasons.
"You lost your job." "That's terrible," said Maureen. "Harold will be very sorry to hear this." "It's all right, Mrs. Fry. I didn't like the job anyway. Customers were always shouting and in too much of a hurry. But what I said to your husband about the power of faith has been bothering me ever since."
She looked fidgety and anxious. She kept tucking the same strand of hair behind her ear, although it wasn't out of place.
"I think I gave him the wrong impression." "But Harold was inspired by what you said. It was your faith that gave him the idea to walk."
The girl sat bunched up in her coat and gnawed at her lip so hard Maureen was afraid she would draw blood. Then she tugged an envelope out of her pocket and removed several sheets of paper. She held them out, but her hand was trembling.
"Here,"
she said. Maureen's mouth bent into a frown.
"Salsa for the over-60s?
The girl reached for the papers and flipped them over.
"The writing's on the other side. It's a letter from your husband." "It came to the garage. My friend warned me to fetch it before the boss saw."
Maureen read in silence, weeping over each sentence. The loss that had wrenched them apart 20 years ago was as lacerating and incomprehensible as if it was happening afresh. When she finished, she thanked the girl and folded the letter, running her nail along the crease. Then she posted the letter back inside its envelope. She sat, very still,
Mrs. Fry?
There's something I need to explain.
Maureen wet her lips and let the words come. It was a relief. Moved as she was by Harold's confession, it felt right to share the facts at last about David's suicide, and the grief that had split his parents apart.
We shouted for a while. I blamed Harold terribly. I said awful things. That he should have been a better father. That the drinking was in Harold's family. And then we seemed to run out of words. It was about that time I began talking to David.
You mean he was a ghost?
Said the girl. She had clearly seen too many films. Maureen shook her head.
Not a ghost, no. More like a presence. A feeling of David. It was my only comfort. I said little things at first. Where are you? I miss you. Things like that. But as time went by, I said more. I said everything that I didn't say to Harold. There were times when I almost wished I hadn't started. But then I worried that if I stopped talking, I would somehow betray David. Supposing he really was there. Supposing he needed me. I told myself that if I waited long enough, I might see him. You read about things like that in those magazines at the doctor's while you're waiting. I wanted to see him so much. She wiped her eyes. But it never happened. I looked and looked, but he never came.
The girl stuffed her face into a tissue and bawled.
Oh, God, that's too sad.
When she emerged, her eyes were so small and her cheeks so red, her face looked peeled. Strings of saliva looped from her nose and mouth.
I'm such a fraud, Mrs. Fry.
Maureen reached out her hand for the girl's. It was small as a child's, but surprisingly warm. She gave it a squeeze.
You're not a fraud. It was you who began his journey. You inspired him when you talked about your aunt. You mustn't cry.
The girl let out another sob and plunged her face back into the tissue. Raising her head again, she blinked her poor eyes and took a shuddering deep breath.
That's just it, she said at last. My aunt's dead. She went years ago.
Maureen felt something falling away. The room seemed to give a tremendous jolt, as if she had just missed her step on the stairs.
She's what?
Words stuck in her mouth. She opened it and swallowed again. Then in a rush.
But what about your faith? I thought it saved her. I thought that was the whole point.
The girl dug her teeth into the corner of her upper lip, so that her jaw shot out sideways.
If cancer's got hold of you, there's nothing that's going to stop it.
It was like seeing the truth for the first time, and realizing she had known it all along. Of course there was no stopping terminal cancer. Maureen thought of the many people who had come to trust in Harold's walk. She thought of Harold trudging, even while they spoke. A shiver ran through her.
I told you I was a fraud, said the girl.
Maureen pummeled her forehead lightly with her fingertips. She could feel more coming from a long way deep inside, but unlike the truth about David, this caused her racking shame. She said slowly,
If anyone is the fraud here, I'm afraid it's me.
The girl shook her head, clearly not understanding. Maureen began to tell her story, quietly and slowly, not looking at the girl, because she had to focus on tugging out each word from the secret place where she had been hiding them for all this time. She told how, 20 years ago, after David's suicide, Queenie Hennessy had come to 13 Fossbridge Road,
asking for Harold. She had looked very pale, and she was carrying flowers. There was something extremely ordinary and yet very dignified about her.
She said, "Could I give Harold a message? It was about the brewery. There was something she needed him to know." And after she had told me what it was, she gave me the flowers and went away. I suppose I was the last person she saw before she left. I put the flowers in the bin, and I never gave him the message. She stopped. It was too painful and too shameful to go on.
"What did she tell you, Mrs. Fry?" said the girl.
Her voice was so gentle, it was like a guiding hand in the dark. Maureen faltered. It had been a difficult time back then, she said. This could not excuse what she had done or not done, and she wished it had been otherwise.
"But I was angry.
David was dead. I was jealous, too. Queenie was kind to Harold when I couldn't be. If I gave him her message, I was afraid he would find comfort, and I couldn't do that. I didn't want him to find comfort when there was none for me." Maureen wiped her face and continued. "Queenie told me how Harold had broken into Napier's office one night. She had seen him sitting outside the brewery earlier that evening in his car. She hadn't gone over. She thought he might be crying and didn't wish to intrude. It was only when the news went round the following day that she had put two and two together. It was grief, she said. Grief made people behave in the strangest ways. In her opinion, Harold was on a course of self-destruction. In smashing those Murano glass clowns to smithereens, he was deliberately challenging Napier to do his worst. Their boss was hell-bent on revenge." Maureen paused and dabbed her nose. "So Queenie took the blame. Being a plain woman, she said, made it easier. Napier was thrown off balance. She told him she had accidentally knocked the clowns while dusting." The girl laughed, but she too was crying.
"You mean to say this all happened because your husband smashed some glass clowns? Were they valuable?"
"Not at all. They had belonged to his mother. Napier was a vicious thug. He had three wives and he gave them all black eyes. One ended up in hospital with broken ribs. But he loved his mother." She gave a limp smile, which hung on her face a moment, until she shrugged and cleared it away. "So Queenie stood there and took the blame for what Harold had done. And then she let Napier fire her. She told me all this, and she asked me to tell Harold not to worry. He had been kind to her, she said. It was the least she could do."
"But you didn't tell him?"
"No. I let him suffer. And then it became another of the things we couldn't say, and drove us further apart." She opened her eyes wide and let the tears fall. "You see, he was right to walk out on me." The garage girl didn't answer. She took a further flapjack, and for several minutes she seemed to be thinking of nothing other than the taste of it. Then she said,
"I don't think it's true that he walked out on you. I don't think you're a fraud either, Mrs. Fry. We all make mistakes, but I do know one thing."
"What? What?"
moaned Maureen, rocking her head in her hands. How could she ever mend the mistakes of so long ago? Her marriage was over.
"If I were you, I wouldn't be stuck here making biscuits and talking to me. I'd be doing something. But I drove all the way to Darlington. It made no difference.
That was when things were good.